Thanks. My name is Janet Dempsey, and I am a member of Al-Anon. And, hi. I've been going to meetings for 29 years. And I guess 22 of those years, it's been a Monday night. And the other ones, I traded for Tuesday. But I've never taken a sabbatical or a vacation. I needed these meetings too bad. As a matter of fact, Jack and I fought real hard who was going to get out the door first. Because he was going every night, and I wanted to go every night, and we needed a babysitter. And I do remember at one point that when I was starting to work a program, and I started to take care of me, and I started to like myself, and we were sitting out on the patio one day, and it was storming, and thunder just hit that patio and knocked us both right up out of our chairs. And we both ran for the door to get in the house. And instead of me allowing him to go first like I always did, I didn't do that. We both got stuck in the door. And we looked at each other and laughed. Because now I was going to take care of me. And, of course, he was taking care of him. So we get stuck in the door. And that's one of the things that I realized that my program was starting to work for me. Is when things like that happened. Because I never thought too much of me. And everybody else came first. Al-Anon in Pittsburgh is 42 years old. And we're married 42 years this year also. And I always thought, you know, what I probably should have done was got married and left the church and went to the Al-Anon meeting and left everybody else go to the reception because I belonged in Al-Anon from the very beginning. But, of course, at that time, I didn't know it. I really would like to say a thank you to a couple little people here, Jeff and Shauna, because you really picked a nice host for us because they took us around. I didn't know much about Hannibal at all. I know a lot now. And they're proud of their town and where they live. And you know what? Jack and I are proud of Pittsburgh and where we live too, so if you ever come there, we'll return the favor. So thanks again. You know, Jack and I met when we were 13 and 14 years old. And so at that time, we were just babies. And he says that he was riding along on his bike one day and I snatched him off and we got married. And I guess that's kind of like the way it happened. But I felt very responsible for this marriage because when I first took a look at him, because he was so young, I didn't want to stop him from drinking because he wasn't even drinking yet. But I could see that he needed me a whole lot. He had a working mother, and he had to get up for school by himself in the morning with the alarm clock, and he had to eat fast foods, and nobody took care of him. Nobody pressed his pants, and I wanted to take care of him. So in my head, I thought, no, I'm going to marry him and take care of him. And my grandson's 18 years old today, and if he'd tell me the same thing, I'd tell him he was crazy. He's too young. But I thought that I could handle this. So we got married, and everything, was really, really nice. And it was wonderful. And about 18 months later, I had this baby in the crib, and she was screaming. And my hair was streaming down, and I was sweating. And I was ironing a white shirt for Mr. Playboy, because he's going out tonight. And he played the drums, and, you know, he, hurry up, I want out of here. He said, I can't stand this baby screaming and hollering. And you know what, I decided that night he wasn't going to go anywhere. And so what I did is I just pulled the iron out of the wall, and I backed him into the corner with it. And his chest was bare, waiting for the shirt. And he just went like this and said, I'm not going out tonight. And so I knew that I had an answer, that I could keep him home if I wanted him home with a hot iron. But I had to keep that hot iron plugged in all the time, and when you have a baby crawling around the floor, that's a dangerous thing. So that wasn't really a good answer. Now, I didn't burn Jack's chest. He doesn't have the mark of an iron on his chest. I just singed a few hairs. And I think today that's why Jack and I are both alive, because I think he knew when he better back down, and I knew when I better back down. And I think that's why we're, you know, we survived each other. I remember at one point in our marriage that things were just so bad that I just didn't care whether I lived anymore, and neither did he. And we were on the second floor in front of this picture window, and he was like this, and I was up there on his hands. And he was ready to throw me out. And I thanked him, and I said, "Thank you very much. Do it." And when I said, "Thank you, do it," he put me down. He said, "No, you're not going anywhere. You're going to stick around and suffer with me." So I didn't go through the window. But just kind of like, after only 18 months, this wonderful marriage, I'm burning him with an iron, and we're having these fights. Now, I think for the next 13 years, what I did was I tried to get him to stop drinking or slow down. To stop him was like very tough. But if I could get him to slow down, and I had people help me, like his mother. His mother was on my side. So, you know what? Your mother loves you no matter what you do. And if she was on my side, I must be right. So here I am again. Now, I'm going to take care of this marriage. Things are going sour, so it must be my fault. But my mother-in-law said that I'm right. So it's not my fault again. So anyway, she tells him, well, I had a lot of talks with Jack because I wanted to know why he drank, when he drank, and what for. And I thought if I would go to him, like he would give me the answer because he's the one that's doing it and he's the one that would know. So I would get him when I thought he was sober, and maybe that's because he didn't have a drink for 12 hours, and I would ask him, "Jack, why did you drink the way you drank?" And he said, "Do you really want to know?" And I didn't realize at the time he was thinking up a good answer. And he told me the reason he drank is because sometimes when he came home from work, I had rollers in my hair. And that made him get drunk. So I believed him. I thought, oh my God, you know, if it's that bad with rollers in my hair, I better do something. So I made a standing appointment at the beauty shop. And I went for a whole year every Friday morning. And every week I would look through the magazine. I was trying to find the hairdo that was going to make him quit drinking. But what happened is I ran out of money first. So I had to stop doing that. I had to think of something else. Now his grandmother, his grandmother also was on my side. See, so this also helped me push and keep going because I had to fix him because no one else cared. So his grandmother told me what I could do is before he goes out, leaves the house, make him eat some grease because that'll coat his stomach and he won't be able to drink as much. And that was real good, but what kind of grease could I get him to eat? And I thought, how could I, hand him a stick of butter and say, "Eat this"? You know, what kind of an excuse? He's not going to do it. So that wasn't a good answer. But I discovered something. Because we went out together, which we were like not doing much anymore because I didn't want to go with him. It was too big of a job. And I had to watch what he did, listen to what he said, run in the next room and explain to these people that he was with what he meant by what he said, you know. And he would be sitting there saying, "I meant what I meant." And I'd say, "No, he didn't," you know. And so I just didn't want to go with him anymore because he would get drinking and he would perform and I would be his audience and, you know, and it didn't work too good. So I started not going. But this one night, it was family, and you know family, you got to keep it up in front of the family, you know, how wonderful things are. And we went, and before we left, I fed him spaghetti. And we got there, and the first things they said is, "Jack, do you want a beer?" And he said, "Oh, no," he said, "I can't drink beer." He said, "I'm so full of spaghetti, I couldn't drink if I wanted to." I thought, now this, I stored that. That's good. That's good. Anytime we were going anywhere together, I fed him spaghetti before we left because I knew he'd gorge himself, you know. And so I kept him under control a little bit by feeding him spaghetti. And so when I first came in Al-Anon, I remember complaining and telling everybody that I hated flannel shirts. I hated flannel. And that's because I always bought him two flannel shirts to wear every year. I would go out about this time of year, and I'd buy two flannel shirts, a red plaid and a green plaid. That's what he always wore. And that's all he needed, because you see, he worked in the mill, and that's all he needed to go to work. And then I I dressed him. I bought him a suit because I bought a black suit because that's good for funerals, weddings, you know, and that's what he had for that. And for playing drums, he did that too. So one suit, one white shirt, two of these flannel shirts. And I hated those flannel shirts. And somebody said, since you hated them so bad, why did you keep buying them? And I never thought, why? I don't know. I think it was because at that time flannel was cheap. It's not anymore. Now it's expensive. But Jack would know when I woke him up where he was going by what the clothes I handed him. And he would know where he was going, you know. He didn't have to ask. But he would tell me. He'd come home and he'd say, look, I'm in trouble at work, and you better get me up for work, and I don't care what you have to do, but you make sure you get me up. Well, I knew that if I woke him up, he'd probably kill me. So I had to get him up, because if I didn't, he said he'd kill me. So I couldn't win. So what I started to do is I would go into the bedroom with a little glass of water, and I would pour a little in his ear, and then I would turn around and I would run out, and I'd sit on the floor and hold the door like this in the hallway so he couldn't get out real quick and get me, you know. So I was getting him up like he told me to do, and I wasn't getting killed if I ran quick enough. So this is the kind of things that I was into doing. Now, when I would wake him up and he would calm down in there, then I could go back in after he was calm and proceed to dress him. Now, if I handed him his flannel shirt, he knew where he was going. And if I handed him his suit and white shirt, he knew that he was going to a wedding, a funeral, or to play drums. And if I wasn't dressed, chances are it wasn't a wedding or a funeral. He was going to play drums. And this is how he knew what he was doing. When he didn't do what I asked him to do, which was, you know, quite often, I would ask him to maybe fix the toilet. He's a plumber, you know. I don't like a bad toilet. I'd like you to fix the toilet. Now, if he wouldn't do that, then he would have to be punished in some way. And I didn't realize it, but I was punishing him like he was my little boy. I treated him like he was my little boy. I fed him in the bathtub. When he didn't have time to eat and he had to get a bath and go somewhere, he'd call me from the bar and say, run my bathtub water, and I would, and then I'd sit there with his plate of food on a toilet, and I'd feed him while he was taking his bath because I wanted to make sure he was taken care of, because wasn't that my job? You know, I went to extremes, I think, to take care of him. But when I would ask him to do something for me, after all, wasn't I doing everything for him? I'd ask him to do something for me, and he wouldn't do it. So I would get angry with him. And a lot of times it was Sunday. I'd usually get angry on Sundays because Sundays, society said Sunday's family day. You stay with your children and you take your wife and, you know, you go out with your family on that day. And I would ask him, you know, stay home with us, take us somewhere. This is family day, you know, and sometimes he wouldn't, sometimes he wouldn't. And when he wouldn't, when I got up on Monday morning to do the wash, I would start his shorts and his socks. And that was a hint from his mother, you know. And you know what? When I would wake him up, he would be so out of it that he wouldn't realize what the problem was. I would hand him his shorts, and he would say, these are kind of stiff, aren't they? I said, well, maybe I didn't get all the soap out. If you, like, rub them together a little bit, they'll probably be okay. And he'd rub them and put them on, and, you know. And he would leave, you know, with these on. Now, I had to do things like that because I had to get even with him somehow for hurting me, and I couldn't do it outwardly because I was afraid he was bigger than me, might hit me or something. So that's the kind of things that I did. And I waited up for him every single night. I mean every night, because I had to make sure that when he came home he knew he was drunk, because I was afraid he didn't know. Now, if it was me, and I got drunk every day, and someone said to me every day, day after day, you're drunk again, you're drunk again, you're drunk again, I'd think, well, you know, I better stop this. And I'd stop it. So I figured someday he's going to hear me, and he's going to say, I better stop this. So I don't care what time it was, I'd stay up and wait so I could remind him he was drunk because I was afraid he didn't know. So, and while I was waiting for him to come home, I wanted to do things. So what I learned was a good thing to do is he came home one day and he went in the kitchen, and I was in the other room, and he slipped on a throw rug in the kitchen because I had waxed the floor. And he grabbed himself, and he's, you know, he's swearing, and, you know, he's going like that. And I'm thinking, now, if he stays out real late, another coat of wax. And I wouldn't put it on. And you know what? And if it was dry and he wasn't home yet, another coat of wax. And I would put lots of coats of wax on his floor. And then after I was done, I'd put the rug on and I'd go upstairs and I would sit down on the steps when I'd hear him coming and wait. And he took rides. He never got hurt bad. But he did take some rides, and he was angry. He didn't know I was doing it, though. So that made it okay, so I wasn't getting it. So this is things that I was at home thinking about while he was out there drinking. I would get up every morning. I would put the radio on, country and western music, and I would cry all day. Every one of those songs. I was in Al-Anon 2 years before they let me listen to that music again. It just upset me so bad, you know. I would hear these songs, you know, and I'd go and please release me. I cried so hard with that. I wanted him to let go of me so bad, you know. And he told me he wouldn't. I asked him for a divorce, and he said, that's crazy. He said, that'll never happen. He said, even if it would, he said, you know what, I'd follow you and your new husband, and I'd sleep between you no matter where you went. So I knew I couldn't do that. And he also told me that all the other men out there were worse than him. He said, they're all worse than me. He said, look, I'm here and they're still down there drinking. And you know what? He fixed that because I thought, if they're worse than him, I never want another one. So he fixed me on that score too. Yeah. He told me that I was never allowed to call the police unless our daughter was sick. Then you call the police. That's the only reason you're allowed to call the police. That's the only reason I called the police. So he fixed me on that. And I believed everything he said, but on the other hand, I believed nothing he said. And I couldn't understand why. I believed everything and I believed nothing. And that was just crazy. And the one song that I remember, From the Bottle to the Bottom, Stool by Stool, thought, oh my God, he's going and I'm going with him because I don't know what to do or how to stop it. I'm trying and I can't do it. Meanwhile, I have this little girl. It's 10 years old. Now, she's my friend. She's on my side. And so when I need to talk, I talk to her. Because, you see, I don't want anybody outside the house knowing what's going on. Because after I get this all fixed, they won't have to know. So I would talk to her. And I would say, now, Debbie, what do you think about getting a divorce? And she said, you know what, Mom? I think that's probably a real good idea because I don't want to live here with him anymore. And I said, okay, tomorrow we'll... That's what we'll do. And then a little while later, she'd start crying, and I'd say, what's wrong? I don't want a divorce from Daddy because, you know what, Daddy, he needs me here, and I don't want to leave. And I said, fine, then we won't. You made the decision to stay here, then it's on your head, and that's what I did. I allowed this little girl to do that because I wasn't capable of doing it. I couldn't leave my house. I couldn't go out on my front porch because I was afraid. I was afraid that people out there would ask me big questions that I couldn't answer. Like, where is Jack? Why didn't he come home? Why did he park on my hedges? You know, and I didn't like that, you know. So what I started to do is I started to run to the neighbors and make excuses for him before they came and mentioned it to me, you know. And I would. I'd run over and knock at the door and say, I'm sorry he parked on your hedges, but he worked 16 hours straight. He's very tired. He asked me to repark the car, and he promises he'll never do it again, you know. And I went through this, you know. And here the next door neighbor, whose hedges, you know, he was always jamming into, he wanted to sell his house. And so he started cutting his hedges and our hedges and his grass and our grass because he wanted to sell his house, and it was not a good idea because our house showed his up too much. So he started being our gardener. And I remember on his birthday, Jack sent him a birthday card to our gardener, which I didn't think was a very nice thing to do. But this is the way we're going. Now, this little girl, she's on my side, see? And we're doing okay. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like she turned And she went to the other side, and she started being on his side. And now here I was by myself. And I was fighting this alone. Because he would take her out with him drinking, and she just thought this was wonderful because she would win money, and she'd buy tea sets, and she'd get all this potato chips and pop. And when she come home, I was the screaming banshee. So I was the one that was wrong, and I was the one that was no good. So now I'm all wrong again. And I had her in the hospital when she was 11 years old. We thought that it was her appendix, but it wasn't. It was a nervous stomach, and we had to put her on medication for that. And she still didn't like me. She still didn't like me. And that was a very hard road to go because I was really alone now because I told nobody. And I was now mad at God because, you know what, God, since I was a little girl going to Sunday school and going to church, if I did the right thing, someday I would be rewarded. And I didn't believe, you know, given a live drunk like this, a reward. It was a lot of pain, but there was no reward in it. And I myself was raised in an alcoholic home, and I didn't know it until I was in Illinois for 10 years because I just thought my home was normal. That's where I lived. And I had one friend, and her father was a real live active alcoholic, and I saw what he did. Their furniture went through the picture windows, and mine didn't. Their Christmas trees went up through the picture window. And he used to chase his wife around the streets with a butcher knife. And that didn't happen in my home. So I assumed that was an alcoholic place. Mine wasn't. And so I didn't really realize that until I was here for a while. But I really got thoroughly calm where I couldn't go outside. It was like 90 degrees, and I'd close my doors and my drapes. And I wouldn't go outside, and I wouldn't let my daughter outside to play either because I was afraid if she'd go somewhere, I might have to go out there and get her. And I didn't want anybody to see me. And I loved rain. Because it seemed like when it rained, everybody stayed in the house, everybody left me alone, and nobody bothered me. So with rain came peace. And so I liked the rain. By this time, we have another little girl. They're 10 and a half years apart, my two daughters, our two daughters. And Jackie was 2 at this time, our little one. And I couldn't stop him from drinking. I couldn't do anything anymore. And you know what? I just fell on the floor one day and started to cry, and I couldn't get back up, and I couldn't talk. And my mother came. My oldest daughter called her, and she came, and she didn't know what was going on because I didn't tell her anything. But she packed a brown paper bag with some of my girls' clothes in it and picked me up, and she took me home with her. And we were up there, and it was a Christmas time, of course. You know, everything happens at Christmas time or a holiday. Everything. So this was Christmas time, and we went up there. And talk about rejection. I was gone 3 days before he knew we were out of the house. He would come home, and he would sneak in. And when he didn't hear me hollering or screaming, "You're drunk again," he'd sneak in on the couch. And the next morning, he'd sneak out. And he did that for 3 days, and he didn't even realize that I wasn't upstairs. You know, when he found out I wasn't upstairs, he tried to find me, and he found us. And I had never left before. I never left the house. And I didn't leave this time either because I couldn't even leave on my own. I was practically carried out. But once I was carried out and I was up there, I knew that I wasn't going to go back there anymore because I couldn't live like that anymore. And I knew it. And I told my mother, I said, "Mom, don't worry about it because I'm going to do something for myself and my girls, whatever that is, I don't know yet. But I said, I'm going to be all right, so don't worry about it." I guess I'll, and I gave him a chance. I left all the children's toys there, and I figured if he, you know, puts them together for Christmas, and of course he didn't, so we had to go back down with my dad's pickup truck and get them and bring them up. And so I stayed there. And I don't know how long I was there, a month, 2 months, I don't remember. But in the meantime, Jack hit a bottom of his own, and he went to a man who was in AA, and this man called me, and when I heard this man's voice on the phone, I knew he was one of our neighbors, and I heard his voice, and I started to cry because I thought, oh my God, Jack's an alcoholic. I didn't know that. And I thought, this is good, you know, at least he's something, you know, because I thought he got to the point where he was a nothing. And so now I thought, well, that's good. He's something. He's an alcoholic. Wonderful, you know. And he says, you want to come home? I said, no. He says, do you want to talk to him? I said, no. I have nothing to say to him, you know. And so anyway, he started going to meetings. And about 3 weeks, I guess, he invited me to go. And I went. And someone asked me about Al-Anon. Now, Jack had done a lot of things before, you know, and I was over here in this room looking at the books and the magazines, and I saw this letter over there from Bill to his wife, to Lois, and it said, you know, I pledge to you I will never drink again, 1928, and then another, I pledge to you I will never drink again, 1929, I will never drink again, 1930, and I thought that was my life, you know. And everything was, I won't drink again, I won't, you know. And I thought, this AA thing is probably just another one of those. But I knew it was different. I looked in his eyes and I saw his eyes, and I knew there was something different about this AA stuff. And so they asked me about Al-Anon, and I was mad at these people in AA anyway, because you see, all these years I have devoted myself to him. He wouldn't listen to anything I said. And he comes into this AA thing, and they're telling him to do stuff, and he's doing it, and he's listening to them. You know, it's like, what's going on here, you know? And I remember going, now, this might not have happened exactly like this, but I remember going to the door of the AA room and wanting to go in there. And they said, I didn't know, honey, you know what? You don't have a problem. This little girl told me, you know. He does, you don't. And I got mad, and I said, yes, I do. And so then I go into Al-Anon, and I'm in an Al-Anon meeting, and they're telling me I have a problem, and I said, no, I don't. So I wanted to have a problem where I wanted a problem, you know, because I kind of like knew in Al-Anon, if I said I had a problem, then make me do stuff. And it wasn't my turn, it was his turn. I tried for 13 years, it's your turn now, you know, and that's the way I felt. There was nothing wrong with me. But I kept going back to Al-Anon because there was no place else to go. Nobody else wanted me, so I kept going. I got a friend who came into the program like 4 months after I did, and her husband, he wasn't even an alcoholic because he told her that. So, but we thought it was a good program for those who needed it. So what we did is we became group starters, and we started groups all over the area for all these sick people, you know. All the groups are still there. There's only one person left. Me. But the groups are all still there. And that's what I was doing it for anyway, was me. So I'm starting these groups, and I'm going to these meetings, and I'm angry. I'm real angry. I'm resentful. I don't want to be here. I don't like him anymore. I don't want to do anything if it benefits him. Nothing. And they're telling me this program was for me, you know. How could it be for me if I don't say anything to him about what he's doing? Because he doesn't do anything right. You know, and I remember his first sponsor sitting at the table in our house saying, Jack, you can do anything you want, just don't drink. I flew out of that chair. I thought I was going to, you know. I said, you have no idea what he does. You have no idea. And he said, he can do anything he wants as long as he don't drink. I thought, oh, my God, I'm really in for it now. Because if he isn't drinking, then he's really going to be aware and be able to do all those things and know really what he's doing. So that was real scary also. But I kept going down, and I started to put blinders on, and I started to say yes to things. Now, my first sponsor that I picked her because she told everybody what to do, and they listened. She carried a clipboard. She said, you sit here, you sit there, you sit here. She told my husband, you sit over here, and he did. I wanted to be just like her, so I picked her. And she said that alcoholism was not a disease. It was self-inflicted. Self. I thought, aha, she's for me. Well, she moved out of town. It's a good thing she did, because I needed to get me somebody else. I needed someone else, and which I did. And that one started talking to me, and he told me that I should, like, do you like the steps? And I said, no, I don't. I don't need them. I didn't do any drinking. And he said, well, do you, he said, you know what? He says, you're very unique. I said, I thought, oh, I knew that, you know. I said, I know. But I didn't know anybody else knew that. And so he said, most people, when they come into the program, they need to work steps. He said, but if you don't, he said, do you like the slogans? And I said, yeah, they're all right. He said, why don't you pick one? I said, I could do them all. They're real simple. He said, well, you know, maybe just try one. You know, don't go so fast. So I told my friend. I said, he told me take one. And she said, I hate them slogans. I said, I hate the steps. She said, I'll tell you what. We'll go home tonight. She said, you do the slogans. I'll do the steps. Tomorrow we'll get together, and I'll tell you what I learned, and you tell me what you learned, and we'll have it down pat. I said, okay. So that's how we helped one another. But you know what? It kept us coming back. We went to a meeting. I swear we went every night, and she drove, and she had this car where I had to get under the hood, and I had to turn the fan belt like this in order for her to start the car. And that's the car we went. We went in a meeting every night, you know. And I found that when I went to a meeting, I felt better. When I went to two meetings, I felt much better. And so I got there as often as I could get there because I really needed it a lot. Things were starting to go smoother for me. But now here comes my oldest daughter. She's 17 years old, and she doesn't like me, I told you. And she decides she wants to get married 4 months before she graduates from high school. And so I went straight from work to a meeting, straight to my sponsor. What am I going to do? And my daughter gave me a choice. She said, if you don't sign for me to get married, I'm running away. He said, well, what do you want? I said, well, I don't want to lose her. So I signed for her to get married. They're married 23 years today, so that kind of like worked out okay, you know, but not at the time. It was bad. She gets married. One of the things that she said she would never do is be like her mother because she hated me. And for the next 10 years, she didn't marry anyone who drank. She would never do that. She married an addict. So for the next 10 years, she was a real pain in the butt because she kept calling me every day wanting me to do stuff for her. And that's how I had to prove my love for her if I said yes. If I said no, then I didn't like her. I hated her. She hated me. And I'd hang up the phone crying, and I'd call someone in Al-Anon, and it went back and forth and back and forth. So I guess it was about, it doesn't really matter. And my mother had called me, and my mother told me that Debbie wouldn't get off the couch, and she was real depressed. And I don't know any answers. All I know is the program. And that's what I did to her when she was younger, is I drug her to Alateen because I didn't know any other answers. And Alateen worked for her until she left and got married. And so I went up the house and I took a friend with me in the program, and I kicked the couch and said, get up, we're going to a meeting, and you know. And I got her to a meeting, but we found out that her problem was leukemia. It wasn't because she was depressed. And Debbie, then, for the next 2 years, we went through hell together because she lost her skin, her sight, her hair. I mean, just everything she lost. And I just was running to meetings and running to the hospital and running to meetings and running to the hospital. And they told me at the hospital that I had to go quick and find people to give her white blood cells. And I ran home and I called two people. I called a person in Al-Anon, and I called a person in AA. And then I went back to the hospital. And the next day, the blood bank called me and asked me to please stop sending people for my Debbie. They said they never had so many people come down there. Please stop. And it just, that's why I bring this up, you know, because that was so super. It's going to be 10 years, and Debbie's still here. And she, every time she would go, she like had 55 bone marrows. And this one time, this one appointment, she said, Mom, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to get any more. I'm done. They're too painful. I can't walk. I can't move. I'm not doing it. And it's like, it was her. What could I say? You know, I just like was quiet and I left her go. And so I waited for her to come back because her husband was with her. And she came back, and she had this little flower. It said, I love you, and she handed it to me. And I said, Debbie, what's going on? What did he say? And she said, Mom, he told me I don't have leukemia anymore, that I didn't need any more bone marrows. Not remission. She don't have it anymore. He said, I have as much chance of picking up leukemia right now, Debbie, as you do. There. I, you know. That's really special. And I have this younger daughter. Now, Julie's my granddaughter. She's 22 years old. And she's a sweetie. But my baby's Jackie. And I couldn't keep Debbie in school. Now I can't get Jackie out. She won't quit. I think I'm going to go to college, Mom. I said, oh, nobody in our family goes to college. Don't do that. I mean, I was the big cheese. I graduated from high school here, you know. And she's going to go to college. So I put my waitress legs on, and I went out there to help her. So she's through 3 years. She said, I think I'm going to go get my master's. I said, my legs are tired. I don't think I could, you know. She said, Mom, don't worry about it. You know what? How many times in my life I heard, don't worry about it, you know. But she did. She won a scholarship and a fellowship down at Washington University for like 7 years to get her master's and PhD if she so chose. So we took her down there and she got her master's. We couldn't get her out of school. And she just won one award after the other. Kept, you know, winning all this money, and I could quit work. And I remember at one point they sent us this plaque in the mail that was to the scholarship family. And it said, if all parents were like you, what a wonderful world this would be. Yeah. Oh, my God. They have no idea, you know. And it's hanging in my living room, and it'll never go anywhere else. It's hanging right there for everybody to see, you know. So this is real super. Now, as my daughter is, we're taking her down to St. Louis. Now, this is an empty nest syndrome now coming, hitting me, you know. And my husband loses his job. Oh, here we are. The plant closes. He loses his job. She's gone out of the house. Now, here we are. We got to start all over again now from scratch. So now he has to go back to school, and he has to finish school, which, thank God, he had started in the past. And so he got his master plumber's license after a couple years. But those 2 years, I think, were really good for Jack and I, because I was able to support him because I understood his loss, and because I was losing my thing, so to speak, and my empty nest syndrome. He understood that I was suffering a loss. And so for those 2 years, we kind of hung together, and it was good. He gets his master license. Now, all the time that he drank, I always wanted to know where he was, what he was going to do, when he was going to come home. And, of course, he wouldn't tell me, you know. So now he's the plumber. I take care of the office. He has the beeper. I'm his boss. I beep him, and I tell him where to go and what to do and when to do it. And now I don't want to know where he is all the time. So that's one of those things where you have to be careful what you pray for, because someday, you know, you may get it, you know. So things, as far as working the steps and making amends, I think my biggest amends was to everyone around me, was to work the program for myself and make myself a nicer person to be around. And I was certainly making amends to everybody else by doing that. And I think number one on that list was me, because I think I hurt myself more than I hurt anybody else, because I tried to be the best mother, the best wife, the best daughter. I tried to be the best of everything for everybody else, and I never, ever thought of myself. Never. I didn't get to me because I wasn't there. I wasn't important. I wasn't a human being. And Al-Anon taught me that I am somebody, that I am a human being, and I can think of me first. I can cook something for dinner that I like. I don't have to worry about pleasing everybody else around that table, because they told me you cannot please everybody. So you got to start trying maybe to please yourself. And I didn't know I was allowed to do that. They told me that it was a selfish program, that I was going to take care of me. And boy, it was so nice to be able to take care of me and not worry about taking care of everybody else. And so that's what I started to do. And when I started to do that, then I started to not look over at what everyone else was doing all the time. So I was able to stay out of their affairs and out of their business and leave them alone, because that's really what's best for me. And as soon as I start thinking up here, I get in trouble. I can't do much of that anymore because that just hurts me. Because I could do a lot of damage with my head. I have a friend who made me a birdhouse, and I never could, like, watch birds or plant flowers or all that stupid stuff, you know, and have time for that. I had important things to take care of and do. And he made me a bird feeder, and I start putting stuff in it and the birds, you know, and they were coming, and it started to be exciting watching all these birds come. I had no idea how nice this would be, and it's so serene to sit there and watch them. And I was at my window one day, and I was looking out there, and all of a sudden I look, and there's a chicken walking across my patio. I live in the suburbs now. There's no chickens. And so I beeped him. I never beep him unless it's an emergency, but I beeped him, and I said, there's a chicken in our yard. And he said, he laughed, you know. And he didn't believe me, so I called my friend, and I said, you know what, Fran? I said, I have a chicken in my yard. And she laughed, and she said, it's probably a dove, you know. I said, I know what a dove is. It's a chicken, you know. So he comes home to see what it is. He found out that he thought someone told him that it was a grouse. And he has a gun in one hand and a shovel in the other, and I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to kill the bird. I said, not my bird, you're not. Because meanwhile, this bird was sitting on the fence, and he, like, fell asleep. And it was snowing, and he sat there. He was on that fence for 24 hours. And I got a hold of wildlife people, and I talked to them. And this girl got on the phone, and she said, she's telling me all the things I should do for this bird, cover it with a towel, put it in a box. I said, I don't want to touch it. So she said, well, she said, there's a couple things that could happen. She said, do you live near a street, a busy street? And I said, not really. She said, well, either this bird got hit by a car and it's stunned, or you have a drunken bird. And she said, that bird might have got hold of some bad berries and it's drunk, and it'll sit there till it gets sober. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. I got it. Now I'm responsible for a drunken bird because she told me. She said, now I want you to be careful because she said, you don't want a cat getting that bird. Because that bird will be, no one will take care of it till it's sober. And so, you know, this cats will get it and maybe kill it. So now I got to watch a bird, you know. And I'm watching this bird. And I left him watch a bird so I could go to an Al-Anon meeting because they're telling me I got to let go of the bird. And I said, I can't. I can't let go of the bird till I find out it's not going to be dead, you know. So after 24 hours, now I'm standing on my bed and I got my video camera and I'm videoing this bird, you know. It stood up. It stood up and turned around, and I'm screaming at him, the bird's up, the bird's up. It flew off the fence, and it went right back over to the other wall, and it sat there and started eating berries. I thought, what am I going to do? Now I got this bird's going to go get drunk again on these berries, you know. So I had a hard time letting go of that bird. I had to go to meetings and, like, not look in the yard anymore. Don't look in the yard. I'd come home from a meeting with a flashlight, and I'd be going out like this looking for my bird, you know, see where he was. You know, it was a big grouse. It was a big chicken. It was big as a chicken. But here I was stuck with the bird, so I had to let go of the bird, too, you know. Oh, I couldn't believe when she said he was drunk. You got a drunken bird on your hands. Of course, I've always have a drunken bird on my hands. I have had to go back to that first step. I can't tell you how many times. Because I think I'm in the program a long time. I think, oh, this one I can handle, you know, and I can't. I got to go back, and I got to go back, and I got to do it as many times as I need to do it. I had a hard time coming here because my mother is very ill right now, and I take care of her 24 hours a day, and I didn't know how I was going to leave, and God put her in the hospital. So she's in a safe place so that I could come here and be in my safe place, because this is a safe place for me to be. Al-Anon is my life. And I was told in the beginning that I had to treat my Al-Anon meetings like they were a doctor's appointment. And I still do that today, because I remember when I started going to meetings, my kids would hang on my legs and cry, don't leave me. You know, and I was told that if you had a doctor's appointment and your kids would hang on your leg and say, don't go, would you go? And I would go. So I do that for my Al-Anon meetings too. It's my doctor's appointment. And I'm there all the time. I can't live without them. I don't know that if I've said anything at all to help anybody here today, but I sure helped myself by being here. And I'm real grateful that I was able to come and be here. And I think I just wanted to say one more thing. And it's this thing between this Al-Anon and AA stuff. You know, there's always something there. And but I just wanted to remind everybody in AA that any drunk can get into AA. But in order to get into Al-Anon, you have to know somebody.